Ezra, I'm ready.
Is there a process for rebuke of any kind of somehow this works for me? I'm going to open that meeting of the House Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities. First thing we need to do, colleagues, is move a bill over to a different committee because we actually don't need to see it here. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2646, which is the eligibility for certain forest land special assessments.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2646 without recommendation to the Committee on Revenue.
Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 2646 without recommendation to the Committee on Revenue. Is there discussion?
Only to hope that, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Shopley.
I just hope they don't cause any trouble with this bill down there. The only thing I have to say.
We'll send a little note in one of your flower baskets.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Perhaps you need to speak directly to the chair.
Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Byer.
I excused.
Representative Winger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Van Arnam.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Shopley.
Aye.
Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Aye.
Chair
Clem. Aye. Motion passes. The measure is sent to the Committee on Revenue. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2583. Now, Representative Logan, would you actually like to come down and testify on...
it was good to have a chance to practice.
Yeah, okay. One of these days we're going to run out of his bill, and I don't know what we're going to do exactly.
I doubt it. We got about him yesterday, so...
Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair Clem, and distinguished members of the Ag and Natural Resources and Rural Policies Committee, including you, Representative Gilmore.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Arnie Roblin. I am representative from District 9, which goes from Coos Bay to Florence, and on the floor I get to be known as the Dunes person. So. This bill, originally in close to the same form, was introduced last session, and it created a furor amongst people because the idea of having this large fine for a person launching their boat caused a bit of angst amongst a lot of my friends. And so it didn't move. And then about a month later, the State Patrol, State Police, observed a boat being traveling through our state from the California to the Washington border, and they encouraged the boat owner to keep going until they got across the border to Washington, where there were some cleaning stations because his boat was covered with some of our little snails. And since then, we've had a couple incidences of those kinds of things happening in our state. And we used to use the protection of the surrounding states as our buffer, and that we didn't necessarily see the need to do the extreme kinds of things necessary to keep some of these invasives out of our state. But they have now made it into California. We're concerned about Idaho, Nevada. And so introduce it again and look forward to suggestions from people in the audience about ways that we can improve this bill before we move it. But my feeling is that currently the risk has gotten greater and greater, and people need to understand the responsibility of ownership. And most of our hunters and our sportsmen out there really do understand that. When it's brought to their attention, they take care of it. The problem is that there are people who just go get their new boat and don't have an idea of what to do. They go down and have a great fun recreation activity, say in a California reservoir of some type, leave it in the water for part of the summer when they're down there, don't recognize that these little guys are in the ballast or on the boat, bring it back to Oregon. Many of them can survive. They go down to their local reservoir or water, place that they want to play, put their boat back in the water, and all of a sudden we have an invasive species that for the most part we have not been able to eradicate anywhere in this country since its introduction. So we need to keep the quaggas and the zebras, mussels out of this area. But there's also a lot of aquatic vegetation that comes back, and we've found that problem in our bays and harbors with the transport of ballast water back and forth, and there's some other bills you're going to see. This one really particularly talks to those of us who like to go and recreate in other places and come back and don't and unintentionally harm our waterways. So the idea is that we'll make it a violation, up to $360 fine. It also gives us the opportunity to actually pull people over if they have a boat that has stuff growing on the outside of it to look at it. We really didn't have that authority and haven't had that authority until recently. So it's important for us to start recognizing that we have a lot of people watching. I would really love to, and hopefully we'll have a conversation about having stations at our and cleaning stations at each of our border crossings so that when people come in, they really have the opportunity to do it. Because I agree that when given the opportunity, people really want to do the right things. We're looking at some legislation you'll see later that does that. But I still think putting this in place and then giving them the opportunity to clean off their stuff. And that could also be things like our four-wheelers and others that we like to use on the dunes and other places. We know that at times in the past we have introduced our own species to help things, i.e. the sand dunes on the south coast and the introduction of European beach grass. It lives there well. Getting rid of it has been very, very difficult, in fact impossible. And so eventually our dunes will be stabilized and they won't be the same place that we like to recreate now, and that concerns me a lot, actually. So the more we know about these things, the more tools we have for the Marine Board and others to make sure that we keep our state as clear from these as possible, the better we are. So with that, I would entertain any questions you might have.
Representative Schaffler.
Only to add, Representative, that I agree completely with what you said. People want to comply, and I think it's our job as governors to get people into compliance rather than put the hammer down on them first. And I don't know what the Marine Board or whoever licenses our boats does in the way of education when you go in to purchase a license or a permit. I imagine they probably give you a handful of pamphlets. I hope we did more than just do that and really get people aware. I mean, there's thousands of boats in Oregon, millions probably, and I bet there's a lot of those boaters out there who have never even heard of a zebra mussel. So just how we get the word out, I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. There's a great pamphlet that's been produced about invasive species in Oregon and other places and good pictures. And you're going to see, we have another bill that talks about some plants and things that we can do to help. We'll do that up today. But I absolutely agree with you, and you're going to hear from the Marine Board people. They're here today, and I think you're going to have some more information about what they're trying to do.
Vice Chair Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I'm unfamiliar with the process and the way things work, so this is basically the Marine Board is the agency responsible for the rules, and the state police are responsible for the enforcement, or is the Marine Board have their own force?
State police do the enforcement. I think you'll find that the Marine Board does some things, and you can ask them, and I don't know exactly their preview with regard to that as well. But, so I think that's a good question for all of us.
Okay.
But it is the state police that generally
do the enforcement.
Though I think there are places where the Marine Board has the ability to do the same thing. And I think the Marine Board is a group of people who truly do take an interest and care in making sure our waterways are safe, the regulations that do it. There's an issue, and I won't bring it up here, Waldo Lake, and I'll talk about that later. Another time, another place.
Where's Waldo?
And I really appreciate the Marine Board.
Any other questions? I've just got one. We're going to meet a public hearing. We can ask some other folks, too. But do you think that the sort of phrasing of aquatic species that is detrimental to wildlife, is that really the right way? Or is there a list somewhere else of invasive species?
I think that you're going to hear some testimony about definitions, and that's probably the place that this bill could use the greatest care in making sure that we get those definitions absolutely correct. We referred to different definitions in this book and to different parts of the ORRs about definitions, but I think you will hear from some people about clearly defining what those are.
Okay, one last question. We've known each other a long time. This is a view that many folks from your part of the world hold. Is it possible a Californian in their swimsuit, is that an aquatic species detrimental to wildlife and we could find them?
This is your opportunity.
I would think that maybe we could have a fee structure as opposed to a fine structure in that case, because if we did the fee structure with regard to that, that would be a lot easier to collect all the time when they come across the border.
I didn't schedule
when it's
work
a fine, we have to find them in the water, and I'd rather get it before they got in the
you
water.
You got to find them in the water?
You
shove them in?
Okay. Bipartisan support for the fee bill.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would if I had a work session scheduled, this would be flying out of here with that answer, but thank you very much.
But I think we do need some amendments to clarify some of that stuff. I feel good about that, too.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I'm going to call Randy Henry, Al Elkins, and Tom Wolf up. Okay, Randy, yeah, please,
yeah.
Welcome.
All right, thank you. Good morning, Chairman Clem, members of the committee. My name is Randy Henry, Operations Policy Analyst for the Oregon State Marine Board and a former member of the Oregon Invasive Species Council and also a current chair of the Diamond Lake Invasive Species Prevention Committee. I thought the best way to start this out would be to do a little bit of an illustration on a recent event. On Thursday, February 26th, just last week, I received a phone call from the Oregon Department of Transportation staff at the Ashland Port of Entry. My ODFW colleague and I have conducted training at all of the ports of entries so they can assist in reporting potentially infested boats. These are typically commercially hauled vessels that come through the ports of entry. The training simply encourages them to call me or my partner if they see a boat fouled with shellfish, specifically zebra or quagga mussels. ODOT staff doesn't have authority to detain a commercially hauled watercraft, but when they reported the concern on Thursday, I worked with the local ODFW biologist and the Oregon State Police to see if we could stop the vessel for an inspection. Please see the color photographs, page 2 of the attachments. Photo number 1 is of the Ashland Port of Entry. This is a very busy place with up to several thousand stops per day. Photo number 2 is of one of the zebra mussel infested houseboats that came up I-5 in 2007. This was one of the boats that we didn't have the capacity at that time to deal with, so we simply escorted it to the Washington border, where Washington was better able to pull it over and decontaminate the boat. Photo number 3 is of Thursday's boat hull after being stopped near Grants Pass. Based on this and other photos, PSU research assistant, I guess, Ian Davidson, who's now studying marine species and hull fouling in Panama, reported the following. We were able to get copies of the photos to him for analysis. And this is his quote, and I can't say any of these words quite right. I see bryozoans, at least 3 different species, serpulid polychaetes, spirorbid polychaetes, barnacles, and oyster valves. The brown tufts could be brios or hydroids. Although everything looks dried out and dead, it looks like some soft tissue remains of an organism or two. And he continues his quote, "That's a good catch, and it's not much effort to take a scraper and power hose to remove it." The point being that even though this was a vessel that had been out of the water allegedly for a couple of years, we don't know that for sure, and that it came from salt water, it had things on it that we didn't know what they were, and it was headed for a saltwater launch up in Washington. So again, the driver claimed the vessel was out of the water for 2 years. It was not deemed a quagga or zebra mussel threat because it came from saltwater. It was headed to Washington, so I alerted Washington in case they wanted to further inspect the vessel as it crossed into Washington. On page 2 of those photos are prevention signs. The top photo is of Big Bear Lake in California. This sign is part of a prevention effort that includes mandatory boat inspections prior to launch. If the inspection point isn't staffed, you simply don't launch your boat. They take the prevention very seriously in California because they're spending tens of millions of dollars per year to deal with the infestations that they already have. In Oregon, we've worked hard to mark all of our boat launches with the signs on the lower left. East Lake, south of Bend, recently became infested with Eurasian water milfoil. Aside from basic outreach, there is relatively little effort to prevent the spread of aquatic weeds within the state. One by one, our waterways are falling victims to invasive species. The attached database lists many of the lakes already infested with several key species. This is not a complete list, unfortunately. At East Lake, we moved quickly to partner with the U.S. Forest Service to post new signs and distribute inspection cards to raise awareness and encourage action before other lakes were infested. This effort will be expanded this summer into a kind of a Tier 2 statewide program and further expanded next year. At Diamond Lake, we've worked hard to prevent another infestation since it was treated in 2006. Working with ODFW and the U.S. Forest Service, we've surveyed hundreds of boaters in 2007 and 2008. Page 3 of the attachment shows a map of Oregon and a diagram of where people come from to boat at Diamond Lake. Based on the 2007 surveys of 559 boaters, 387 of these boaters had boated elsewhere in the previous 4 weeks. That's about the time a zebra mussel can survive out of water. The graphic shows where those 387 boaters came from. They came from 76 unique water bodies and 69 unique towns, including 5 visitors from out of state. Some of those boats had, just 48 hours earlier, been in waterways infested with New Zealand mud snails, Eurasian water milfoil, and parrot's feather. At least 2 visitors to Diamond Lake last summer were stopped as they entered the campground by people that we had trained in invasive species prevention. They recognized that the boat trailers had weeds on them. They noticed that the boats were coming from Paulina Lake, or they talked to the operator and found the boats were coming from East Lake, and asked them, directed them up to a wash station near the gas station at Diamond Lake to clean their boat before they launched it. Never launch a dirty boat has become the centerpiece of our sustainable boating message at the Marine Board. In 2008, we worked with Oregon State Police and ODFW to develop the quagga and zebra mussel enforcement strategy and protocol, which is also in your attachments. We've matured in our ability and willingness to address this issue. But here's the problem. To address this issue with existing laws, we require officers essentially to be taxonomic experts. And if you've ever tried to tell one water weed from another, it's not easy. I don't pretend to be able to do it. I call on people like Mark Sitzman behind us. House Bill 2583 is similar to legislation introduced in 2007, but with one important change we'd like to see addressed. Section 2A states that launching is prohibited if invasive species are visible on the boat and trailer. Since transport of invasive species is already illegal under ODFW's wildlife integrity rules, this doesn't provide a significantly different tool than what we've already got. When the bill was originally proposed in 2007, we proposed that the invasive species qualifier be left out of that, so that if your boat simply had aquatic species on the hull, you would be required to clean it before launching. ODFW has proposed several other amendments to clarify definitions, which we support. They also proposed an amendment that would essentially exempt people. It would provide some flexibility, I guess. One of the concerns about this bill in 2007 was a person at a very remote lake, a long ways away from any cleaning facilities, if they pulled their boat out one afternoon and it had weeds on it and they wanted to launch in the very same water body the next morning, that shouldn't be an issue. The weeds were already there. They're not going to reintroduce anything. And that may be something that we want to address through an exemption if you're at the same water body. Part of the reason I did the illustration I did at the beginning was to show that not all invasive species are, we don't know what all the invasive species are right now. That boat coming up from I-5 had things on it that we couldn't readily identify. To require an inspection to identify every organism on a fouled boat would add a high level of complexity when cleaning the boat is a relatively simple solution. And it's not different than other states are already requiring, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and several others that require boats to be cleaned before they're launched. We've worked hard in the last 2 years to help train more than 300 law enforcement personnel, biologists, state and federal staff, campground hosts, volunteers, even guides on aquatic invasive species and watercraft inspection techniques. House Bill 2583 could, with this and with ODFW's recommended amendments, provide us a critical tool to keep boats that are contaminated from launching in Oregon's waters. Also in the packet is an interesting article that came out just last week updating the current quagga mussel infestations in the West and the level growth of those organisms in Lake Mead and the impacts to specifically to Hoover Dam and the water supply facilities. It's a really fascinating article from a newspaper in the Midwest. Now, you asked several questions about what the Marine Board is doing as far as education. We do have a number of publications that are distributed regularly. We feature aquatic invasive species, specifically zebra and quagga mussels, at our boat shows with some very nice displays. A number of handouts are available at those. We provide a direct mail newsletter, 16 pages last year, to every registered boat operator in the state that had an extensive article on zebra and quagga mussels and their risks and how to clean your boat and prevent those. And we work very closely with the Invasive Species Council, with the Diamond Lake Prevention Group, and we're expanding our efforts to reach every individual boater in the state with the message, you know, never launch a dirty boat. And from my experience at the Portland Boat Show and in talking to people over the phone and other places, is that we've had a sea change in understanding on this issue in the last 4 years. Whereas 4 years ago, very few people understood the issue. People may not be able to name the creature right now, but they certainly know, they talk about that shellfish that we need to watch out for. And it's a very significant difference that I personally noticed. That's all that I have. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. Yeah, you were touching up on it there at the end. You have a database of boat owners and people that have licensed boats. Have you ever done a survey of those folks, of sampling, to see exactly what percentage of the boaters do have knowledge of or are at least somewhat aware of this issue?
We do. One of the campaigns that we do is a sustainable boating campaign, and it was focused on invasive species this year. And that included billboards and newspaper and various other outreach tools through last summer. We contract through a Portland public relations firm to do that. And that is followed in October by a phone survey. I should have brought those numbers with me, and I could certainly make them available. But we were able to get reasonably good baseline data on the recognition. Again, people don't, probably 20% of the people could specifically name zebra and quagga mussels as a concern. But I believe 50 to 60% talked about things attaching to your hull from other states. And they named without, without prompting, they named cleaning your boat as one of the primary responses to prevent an infestation. That gives us good information to work from in the future. At the East Lake, we actually used the East Lake project last summer as a study. Before we posted any of the signs at the boat ramps, we worked with the Forest Service to monitor people's behavior as they pulled their boats out. Were they cleaning their boat? Were they pulling the weeds off their trailer? And 40-50% were, 40-50% weren't. Then we put up signs on sawhorses, literally right on the edge of the boat ramp so you couldn't miss it. And it said, please save Central Oregon's lakes. And then another sign at the tie-down station had specific actions on how to clean your boat. It told you where to look on your boat and your trailer to remove the weeds. That was combined with a rack card that had a self-service questionnaire on one side, how to clean your boat, and on the other side was basic information on some of these weeds. After those had been up for several weeks, we surveyed people again, and we found roughly the same number of people cleaning their boat. But it gave us good baseline data on how to get the material out there and how to work with people to make it a better message. So we're going to continue to improve on that in the coming year and make it a more active, kind of in-your-face effort, especially at infested water bodies.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Couple of things. When I buy a new boat, do I get some information when I buy a boat of some of the rules of the state, and would I get some information about what we're talking about today?
You should. We provide new boat packets to dealers around the state, and these are handed out. These have evolved over time. Currently, the bag is one of those reusable shopping-type bags that are popular now. It includes a bilge pad to address hydrocarbon releases, oil leaks, and things like that, as well as information on invasive species. We can always do better on those things, but there are a lot of competition, life jacket safety messages and other messages that go in with that that are equally important to other people. So we try to work that message in as a visible priority.
I have a follow-up.
Yes.
So then the next question I have is, since I live in Hood River County, we have boards and we have ski-dos. I presume that's what they call them. What are they? Yeah, whatever. Are those a problem? Will those pick up things?
Well, they can. Anything can that can have a weed attached to it. They're not as big a concern for zebra quagga mussels because they're not typically moored for any length of time. You go out, you spend, you know, time on the water, and then you put it back on the trailer and haul it home. Some of the biggest risk comes from boats that are moored, but there are boats that have internal ballast tanks that would be a concern. Some sailboats have internal ballast tanks where you draw water in to help provide ballast. Wakeboard boats have internal ballast tanks. We are concerned about those, and we haven't quite figured out that problem. If somebody used that type of a boat on Lake Mead, then came back to Oregon, I suppose juvenile mussels could survive in there for up to several weeks. And that's where education becomes such a strong issue, because enforcement just isn't going to catch some of those things.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I have a question.
Oh, Representative Wingert.
Is it possible just to shut down the borders of Oregon and not let anybody else in?
That would be up to you.
I could co-sponsor that with you if you wanted to work on it.
We can call it the Tom McCall bill.
Yep. Right. Okay. Thank you. Al?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins with the Oregon Hunters Association. First of all, I'd like to thank you for last Thursday night, and we really enjoyed ourselves, and I know the committee did too. The one comment that's consistent from everybody that I've talked to or emailed me is that all the committee members stayed through the whole hearing till after 9 o'clock, so that was most impressive with all of those folks. So thank you all very much. We greatly appreciate it. We are here in support of House Bill 2583 today. When I sent this bill out to our legislative committee, they raised a similar question that you did, Mr. Chair, in relation to definitions, and both for aquatic species and plant invasive species, if that were something that also needed to be in the bill. We didn't know that. We understand the role of the Marine Board. And we understand that the Department of Ag also does plant invasive species, as well as ODFW doing the aquatic. So maybe we could get definitions from both of those agencies. I don't know how important that is in relation. And we'd also like to work with the Marine Board in getting word out through our bi-monthly publications. Any way that we can help get this message across, we would be more than happy to. That concludes my testimony.
Questions for Al? It was definitely our pleasure to hear from not only your members, but the other hunters, whether they're members or not. It was really quite a phenomenal experience.
Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you. Real quick question. You heard the Marine Board talk about the fact that identifying them that they are invasive is hard to do, and maybe it's just the idea of cleaning them. Is there a way we could do both, put the definitions? If there's going to be a fine, it would have to be that you had the real invasives, if you launched it, but that the idea of cleaning it and getting all that stuff off is the more important message. Is there a way you think we can work on this to make that happen?
Chair Clem, Representative Roland, while he was talking, I thought that if we put anything in the bill, that it would probably be obsolete by the time it got to the next chamber. So perhaps websites that all three agencies have, with a continual change from what the definition is and what they are and how to identify them, would be helpful. I know our members use a lot of ODFW and the ODA's website to gather information, and that would be ongoing. They could update that at all times. That's the only thing that I see that would be fluid to keep up with what it is and what it is not.
Yeah, that's okay. Thanks.
Okay, great. Tom.
Chair Clem, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, representing the 3,000 members of Trout Unlimited here in the state. We are part of a 166,000 member organization that is the largest cold water conservation organization in the United States. And we are definitely in support of House Bill 2583. One of the major problems that's facing aquatic ecosystems right now is invasive aquatic species like zebra mussels, quagga mussels. Those are major ones that, as were stated earlier, they are on our borders. Once they get into our waters, it is practically impossible, if not impossible, to remove them. So the best thing we can do is to prevent them from getting in the waters. And we support education, and we believe that we should do everything we can to educate fishermen, boat owners, but there also needs to be some sort of ways to stop people, and if need be, penalties if for people that are bringing these in, because sometimes education just isn't enough. So we like the language of House Bill 2583, and we urge the committee to pass this. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Any questions for Tom? All right. Thanks. Thanks, gentlemen. We call up Terry Witt and Mark Sitzma.
Morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Terry Witt with Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I'll be very brief this morning. We are in full support of House Bill 2583. I currently serve on two invasive species advisory committees, one to the Invasive Species Council, another to the Marion County Weed Board. And I think at a previous hearing I had mentioned how prolific some of these freshwater mussels can be, and I would just like to reiterate that, because it doesn't take much of an introduction to create a problem that that can't be eradicated over a period of time. One adult lays about a million eggs. Of those million eggs, 1% survive to adulthood. If you carry that out in three generations, you wind up with 100 million adults. Three generations. So you can imagine what would happen if we allowed in 100 zebra mussels or quagga mussels, and they were able to start production in a freshwater system in the state of Oregon. It would be an epidemic. With that, I'll be glad to answer any questions, but Mark is the real expert here, so I'll defer to him. Just ask your support of this bill.
Any questions for Terry? On any topic, since we got him up here, I mean, just anything. That's inappropriate with this. We're in a hearing on a bill. I'm sorry. Mark.
Yes, thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Mark Sitzma. I am the Chair of Environmental Science and Management Department at Portland State University and the immediate past chair of the Oregon Invasive Species Council. The council was formed by the legislature in 2001 to try and coordinate invasive species management in the state. It's comprised of state, local, federal, tribal, nonprofit organizations, academic representatives, and industry representatives, and as well as has an advisory committee of 30 people that represent numerous organizations throughout the state, including Terry. The mission of the council is to coordinate a comprehensive effort to keep invasive species out of Oregon and to eliminate, reduce, or mitigate the impacts of invasive species already established in Oregon. And I see this bill as really critical to that prevention effort. That's really the focus of it. We have done studies. We know that in coastal lakes, there's a very high correlation between the number of invasive plant species in a lake and presence of boat ramps in the lake. And this is really evident to people that are familiar with the South Coast lakes, where we have lots of lakes that are infested with aquatic weeds. These weeds were introduced by probably two ways: an aquarium dump or a boat trailer was hauled from one lake to another. And I think in many of these coastal lakes, it's most likely these boat trailers are spreading weeds. So this bill really addresses that question. The issue about identification of these organisms is really a critical one. They are difficult to identify, even for me. I have some difficulty with some of the plants sometimes. So I think it's important to modify the bill in some way to specify more clearly what people should be looking for, so that there's this probable cause is the issue with stopping these boats, and a state police officer really can't be expected to be able to identify Eurasian water milfoil on a boat going down the road at 60 miles an hour. So I, in my mind, just a blanket prohibition of transport of organisms on boats is the way to go. Sort of takes away that problem of identification. That's in my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mark? Representative Roble.
So Mark, last session you were here when we had this similar bill.
Yes.
And this seems to be different testimony. From other people, not you. I'm just saying.
Well, that's good.
Things have changed, though. I mean, I think the recognition, I think the council, other kinds of stuff, people recognizing what could happen and the fact that it has invaded these border states have made this a much more important issue right now.
Yeah, Chair Klim, Representative Roebelin, I think you're right. A number of things have happened. The Marine Board has done a great job at really focusing on educating boaters, and that's one thing that's happened. The Silent Invasion video documentary came out on OPB. A lot of people have seen that. It's run several times now.
Yes, it has.
Oregon Field Guide has done segments on invasive species. So I think public awareness is increasing. The Invasive Species Council has been much more active in the last year because we have had a coordinator for the council, so we've done a lot more education and outreach activities. So I think public awareness is really increased
the same one
on this
and
issue.
It drove everybody last night.
Other questions for Mark? So Oregon Lakes Association still exists?
Chair Clement certainly does exist.
He's still involved with it?
I am. Yeah, yes, no. We had a meeting in Wallowa Lake, which is, of course, a long ways away from most other places in Oregon last year, and so attendance was low, but we hope to come back to the coast or Diamond Lake next year, where we always get great turnout at the coast or in Diamond Lake. So,
well, Mark has been probably the leader in Oregon for a long time. I met him in 96. So it's been 13 years now, and he was talking to me about why my boss at the time, Senator Wyden, needed to hear about invasive species and how important it was and what was coming and all of these efforts around the state. I always find you there. And he's good at lobbying because he started talking about 10 Mile Lake. He figured out where I grew up, where I like to go, and then telling me about it. And sure enough, I'm writing on my memos, boy, Ron, we got to get on this stuff, invasive species. This guy Mark Sisson is amazing. He's got all this information. So thank you for all your work. Clearly, now, when people come into my office with just their legislative agendas, a variety of different groups, there it is, and working on combating invasive species. So your efforts are paying off, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great. That's all I've got for this bill. Anybody in the audience didn't get on the sign-up sheet? All right. I am going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2583. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2221. We've got ODF and W. Kurt's going to start us off. And then we've got seven witnesses. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director, Department of Fish and Wildlife. It's a pleasure to be back before you here this morning to discuss with you our bill, House Bill 2221, as it relates to feral pigs. I have with me today Mr. Rick Boatner. He's our recently hired invasive species coordinator. So if we have specific questions, have Rick here to help me answer those. We've provided written testimony, which you all should have a copy of now, and I won't go through it word for word. I want to hit some of the high points and then let you hear from the public that's here as well today. Feral swine have long been recognized as a threat to Oregon's ecosystems, wildlife, and agricultural industry. As early as the 1970s, education efforts were begun to address this issue. And during the 2001 legislative session, House Bill 2158 was enacted, which provided clarity for the definition of feral swine, and subsequent to that, the Department of Agriculture has adopted rule which defines feral swine. That definition is relied upon in our proposed legislation here, and I won't go through verbatim the definition of feral swine. Our bill, House Bill 2221, would make it illegal and a Class A misdemeanor to sell or purchase hunts for feral swine on public land. The bill would authorize the Fish and Wildlife Commission to impose a civil penalty of up to $1,000 for conviction of a violation and also revoke all hunting licenses, tags, and permits for 24 months after conviction. Not 24 hours, 24 months after conviction. House Bill 2221 also prohibits a land manager from knowingly allowing feral swine to roam on their property that is owned or controlled by them. Some just a little bit of biology on feral swine. They're highly productive. They have very high reproductive capacity, and they're habitat generalists, so they can easily adapt to a wide array of habitats. Due to their high reproductive rates, harvest rates in excess of 70% only control the population. It does not lead to declines in population. And in the states, even in states with very large large hunting programs for feral swine, they harvest about 40 to 50% of those animals. We did provide you with some figures, and I apologize since they're for the whole country, but if you look at figure one, it shows feral swine populations during 1988. And you'll see they were confined largely to Texas, Florida, a few in the southeast, and some populations in California. Figure two shows those same feral swine populations in 2004. You'll see that there's been great expansion particularly in Texas and California, also in the southeast. And you'll see in 2004, for the first time, those populations are showing up. They're large enough, at least in Oregon and Central Oregon, to show up on this map. Figures 3 and 4 are Oregon-specific, showing the feral swine populations that we were aware of in 2004 versus the populations that we're aware of in 2008. We've seen some expansion there. We currently estimate that we have between 1,500 and 2,000 feral swine in the state of Oregon.
So, Kurt, just a question. So, I'm more familiar with the Hawaii situation more than the others, but like in Hawaii, it seems like that's part of the program is somebody let them out, they're all over the place, and now that's one of the sporting activities people engage in. Was that on purpose, you think, by the state, or once it happened, then they had to figure out how to deal with it?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, I'm not directly familiar with the Hawaii situation, whether it was a state introduction or an individual introduction. Introductions are commonplace, and were commonplace over the last 100 years in many areas, and it would not surprise me if those were intentional in Hawaii. Certainly in the states that currently have feral swine populations and large populations, we do know that individuals have intentionally released those animals to establish populations and then sell hunts for those. So we're looking at this as, again, just as we heard on the previous bill discussion, a case of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. If we can take away the incentive for introducing and establishing these populations, we think we'll have one leg up on controlling them in the long run.
Just out of curiosity, do you know when people then do hunt them because it's a problem and they're trying to figure out how to deal with it, did they use dogs for that? I was on hiking in Hawaii. I didn't see another human being for 8 hours in this one hike, and then this one guy drove by, and he must have had 20 dogs in the back of his car.
Okay.
And I assume he was going for, I thought, pigs, whatever the term is, but, yeah.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, I think there's a wide array of techniques that can be used to control feral pigs, and I'll ask Rick dogs are certainly one of them. And we have had populations, feral pig populations in Oregon, I think most recently in the Bully Creek area over near Vail, where a population was discovered, and a group of private individuals went in and essentially took care of the problem, and that population is now gone.
Vice Chair Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. On the map on 2004, I'm trying to look at this, and of course, I always look to Wisconsin because that's where I'm from, and I go there a lot. And I'm looking at my little county in the corner, Illinois on the bottom of the Mississippi on the south, Mississippi on the west. And it's blank, and there are a number of counties that have, they're white with a line through. So I'm presuming there's no evidence of swine in that particular county. Is that what this map means? See the white counties with a slash in it?
Chair Clem, Representative. The ones that don't
have... Can I get you just to say your name for the record this first time?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, Rick Boatner. I'm the Invasive Species Coordinator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. In the 2004, we didn't have confirmed sightings in that area.
Okay.
So that's why the, if you will, the pig feet is not on that area.
Okay, follow up.
Yeah.
So a presumption that I might have, based on my experience of having lived in those states, and Representative Schaffler can probably relate to this, is that there are a lot of hog producers in these areas. And so I was wondering, wondering if feral swine were indeed a threat to local hog producers because of the disease and...
Chair Clem, Representative Van Orman, certainly feral populations have the ability to carry and transmit disease to domestic populations, and that is one of the issues. I think the agriculture industry, you know, feels strongly about that. I think in the case, what you're seeing in Wisconsin on that map is the fact that there's lots of hog producers, but they're containing and confining their stock. They're making sure that they're not going out and establishing populations in the wild. So it's an animal husbandry issue. They're keeping them well contained.
So that raises another question. So, thank you. I'm sorry. So the feral swine actually come out of a domestic stock?
Chair Clem, Representative Van Orman, that's correct.
Ah.
The feral swine populations were generally established through domestic swine that were released or in some cases probably escaped, but in many cases released intentionally.
Thank you. Didn't realize that.
Representative Irwin.
Thank you, Chair. Do we have any cases in Oregon yet of transmission of disease from feral into our other populations, either people or livestock?
Chair Clem, Representative Roebland, not that I'm aware of. We can certainly follow up on that if you'd like.
Thanks. Representative Schaffler?
Thank you. I'm fairly confident, like Texas, they've just been releasing them willy-nilly to hunt them. These, you can consume these. They taste good, just like regular pork. Is that correct?
Chair Clem, Representative Schaffler, that is correct. I think they certainly are probably not the same, and I don't want to say quality, but they're not the same product that you would find from your feedlot, but certainly very highly preferred and valued.
It's not corn-fed Iowa pork, I'm sure of that. But,
you bet.
And then can you just, if you own the land or if you have permission to hunt on the land, can you just hunt these whenever you feel like it? And I would hope that is the case in Oregon.
Yeah, Chair Clem, Representative Roebland, that is correct. Right now you can hunt feral swine or swine on private land. It's not subject to our regulation.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got to Curry County. There were hundreds of them. Today we have very, very few, if any. It's, the population is way down. But you're taking a right of a person to have this, and you're giving and the state is saying that we have a responsibility to control those animals because they have an impact on the environment. Well, I'm telling you that you have the responsibility to portray your bear numbers on my property because I've got $400,000 worth of damage on my property from bears. So you're not accepting the responsibility that I've been talking to this department about for the last 6 years. I had Roy Elker up on my tree farm to verify that, you know, I've had that type of damage. But yet we're coming to a private landowner and telling them that in the long term best interest of the state, these things may do. And then you have 5 points over here: increased spread of noxious weed, reduction of forest and regeneration production. Three of those five bears do right here in the state of Oregon. And we have numbers totally out of control. Now, I realize it goes back to the meeting the other night, Mr. Chair, about cougar. They don't have the tools in the toolbox to use bait and to use dogs to keep the numbers within reasonable levels. But I just wanted to point out that we're putting burdens on people to do things, and because of an initiative process that was flawed, issues that were mischaracterized, the people in the state of Oregon have been led down this trail. And it would be nice if we had a governor and if we had a commission that would say, hey, enough is enough, let's take care of this issue. I agree with what you're trying to do, but also we need to address predators in Oregon that are doing three of the same of these five things on not only private land but on public land.
Good input.
Okay.
Got my vote.
You guys good to go? If there's no more questions,
we appreciate okay. Chair Clem, members of the committee, we appreciate your time this morning. I did also want to pass on the thanks for last Thursday night. We were here till the end as well, and we thought it was a great hearing, a great opportunity for our constituents to come before this committee.
I thought it was great. I had a few nasty emails, but not very many. Mostly really nice ones.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you. You bet. Okay, I've got Joe Ricker / Al Elkins. Not sure if that's how we get a twofer going, but I think so. So Dave Wiley, how about have you come up as well? Okay, so Joe and Al, who's starting?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Al Elkins with the Oregon Hunters Association. With me to my left is Joe Ricker, a board member, and he's going to carry this bill, testimony on this bill today. We have a policy on feral pigs that Joe will explain and why we support this bill.
I'm Joe Ricker, Midwest Director, Oregon Hunters Association. I live in Salem, 5985 Basil Street. Chair Clem and committee members, and thank you for letting us testify on this bill, and also thank you for last Thursday night. I didn't stay the whole evening because I was suffering from a severe cold, but that's gotten better. So, on House Bill 2221, feral swine, the Oregon Hunters Association supports the eradication of feral swine in Oregon. We recognize that it does provide an opportunity for hunting. However, we think the damage that it does to the native species, the disease issue, and the damage to the ecosystem that's why we support the eradication of these wild boar. I have had the opportunity to hunt wild boar in two different continents, Europe and New Zealand. If you have any questions in regard to how to hunt those, I can explain how we did it. I'm not going to read our points. I've provided you with the points that I wanted to make, and so that's the end of my testimony, unless you have some questions for me.
Questions for Joe? Thanks for coming down again. It's good to see you again. And you know, we can get you, I'm sure, if you're not internet savvy, we could get you a DVD or CD if you'd like of the rest of the meeting to just listen to.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Al, you're good?
Yep.
Great, thanks. This must be Dave.
Okay, Representative Clem, members of the committee. My name's Dave Wiley, and I'm a member of the Oregon Hunters Association, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, Mule Deer Foundation, Ducks Unlimited, etc., etc. I'm here to testify, of course, in support of 221. And this is, we'll make it a crime, as we've all heard, to hunt or sell, to purchase or sell hunts for feral swine. And this is, as Representative Krieger points out, is a vital tool in the process. These are non-native species. They're predators by law. They eat wildlife and wild birds, carry infectious diseases that can be spread to native wildlife and domestic stock, destroy habitat, destroy agricultural crops, and they reproduce, as you've heard, at an amazing rate, 70%. And we've got them scattered all over the state. I'd like to point out, if you look at that map that ODF&W provided, that these babies travel a lot faster across the state than they would if they had to travel on their own 2 feet. And that's indicative of the issue. Cannot be ignored. So why should we protect them? Well, we've got an agricultural economy
and we have a wildlife economy. And as you heard the other night, our wildlife economy for hunting and viewing produces something like $1.5 billion to the state, and something like greater than 19,500 jobs there. So control of the swine now, while the population is small, is going to be a good deal less of an investment than if we have to try and do it later. This bill, passage of this bill, is key to the control effort. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Nice to see you, too. Any questions for Representative? I'm going to call you Snowball, but let's go with Gilliam.
Whatever works for you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I should probably also ask this of our friends from Fish and Wildlife, but is there any way you see for hunters to help in the eradication without being part of selling, buying, selling, or encouraging new swine? I'm not making that very clear. Are there ways for the hunters to help us eradicate it? So I guess what I'm getting to, without being barred from hunting swine until the population's where we want it or eradicated.
This Representative Gillum, the hunters continually and always help in management of wildlife, and they obviously will hunt them without paying. Once this passed into law, of course, it becomes illegal to purchase a hunt. And so the financial incentive is removed, or I should say there is a disincentive added to the purchase. But we're hunting them now in many places.
So, follow up?
Yeah, please.
So I'm sure it's my lack of knowledge and misunderstanding. Then we're just taking with this bill, we would just take the business end out of it, but it wouldn't end hunting of swine.
That's correct, sir. That is correct. It wouldn't impact the hunting of them.
And can I keep that, please? Another follow-up. So can we continue to hunt them on private, or is under this bill we could continue to hunt them on private and public or other places?
And we're giving nods. So when ODNF and FW is up, they mentioned that you don't have to have a tag. You can go hunt them in these places. Nothing changes that.
I apologize for missing that part.
No problem. Yeah, is that a bunch of nods all over the place?
You have to get permission from the private landowner, though, just so you know.
Yeah. So you got to get permission from the private landowner.
We're trying to protect you personally here. Yes, you can't just start.
But you could still hunt on private land, just not for, they couldn't do it for profit. They being
the landowners. Yeah, the landowners couldn't make money off of it.
Yeah, landowner can't charge you and they let you on. And so actually, I think there's an interesting thing here. So I think what you're thinking about is if they just consider it a damage situation, could you please, I'll pay you if you'll come get these things. That's what you're worried about, would we hurt that? And I think what we're hearing is that there's plenty of guys or gals, whoever, will come out and do it for free and help them. So there's no need to have that offer on the table because there's people who would do it.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay, that's helpful. So they would come and save their bacon.
Just so I can clarify this.
Was that all?
No. Yes, it was.
No, it
was. It was all leading up to that.
It's with Ron. With Ron, I'm sorry.
Representative Shopler.
That's in payment for the snowball comment.
Yes, it is. Yeah, I deserved it.
The reason we want to not have landowners charged to hunt feral swine is so that we don't encourage
them to let them go.
And sent them to continue to have them on. If there's nothing on the board, hunters can still go out and take advantage of them. That's if I'm understanding.
Joe, you had.
Representative Clem, committee. I get, as a Midwest director, I have a very large email tree from members and other people. And I get requests of where to go hunt feral swine on numerous occasions. I mean, I get. Over a year's time, I'd probably get 100 emails asking me where they could go to hunt feral swine. And I was referring to ODF&W to say, you know, tell them where they are, and then they've got to go find a landowner that's willing right now. The problem is finding a landowner that's willing to provide to allow you access because there is an incentive to charge for people to hunt. So that's the issue, is if we make it illegal for them to charge, maybe there will be more access, and some of these hunters that are wanting to go hunt them will be willing to spend their time and money and gas to go there and help eradicate them.
That's excellent. Representative Wingard.
Joe, I don't know whether this is a question for you or for the department, but we generally have kind of put it into people's heads that when they're out hiking and out in nature and they see a can or a piece of litter to pick it up and to help out with that. I'm wondering how much this issue has penetrated with the hunting community so that there is a sense that if you're out hunting other things and you happen to see a feral pig, that you should treat that as an eradication moment. In other words, that hunters understand that that's like wildlife litter, and you'd like to get rid of that as quickly as possible. In other words, to turn and hunt it. I'm just wondering how much this has penetrated, or if it would help to have some kind of an education campaign to encourage hunters wherever they are to treat this as an invasive species and to act on it wherever they see it.
I think... Chair Clem, Representative Weingard, I think that has penetrated the members of OHA. We've had articles in our OHA magazine about feral swine, the fact that we need to eradicate them. Attached to the back of my testimony was an article that was written by a member of ODF&W. We published that in our magazine, talking about eradicating these feral swine. And I would venture to say there's very few members of OHA anyway that do not realize that if they see a feral swine out there, to put it on the ground. Because they do damage to a lot of wildlife. They'll kill anything and eat anything they can get their mouth on, including fawns, pheasant eggs, quail eggs, whatever they can get a hold of, they'll eat it. And so I think that has penetrated the hunting community.
Thank you.
Excellent question. Do we have things in the syllabus occasionally on this topic? Yeah, or synopsis, sorry. Yeah. For some reason, I think I was still in college again. Representative Roblin.
I just want to make a comment to Representative Wingard's comment, and that is that hunters have been very active with regard to when they buy their tags for elk and deer to always get a cougar permit as well. The price is really low. It allows them if they were. The problem is that they're tracked by the cougar more than they ever see the cougar. But they are available, and you will see that there have been more incidents because we've got so many more cougar out there where hunters have taken some of those in their pursuit of other animals. But it's just kind of and the Hunter Association and others have really encouraged them to pick up that extra permit while you're there just in case. So I think the same would be true in the feral swine issue.
Well, if you think about it, even in fishing, I remember which one it is, but there's some fish we don't want in there, and they'll pay you up at, it's on the Columbia.
Shad, I think so.
Yeah, what is it?
Pike minnow.
Pike something?
Pike minnow.
Yeah, anyway, if I catch one, I know I can get $6 or $8 or something for it if I drive it up to the place, or you just throw it in the bank and kill it.
Just fight with wolves.
Representative Wingard?
Well, I was just going to suggest, I don't know if... using decoys like with ducks, I'm not a cougar hunter, but if using some kind of a decoy is helpful in drawing the cougar out, I know that Representative Gilliam has a snowball costume, and we might dress him in that and put him out, use him as bait to draw out the cougars, but it's just a suggestion.
Just slather him in bacon.
I think we're going to let you gentlemen go. I know we've got a couple other bills. Thank
you. We are deteriorating.
Thank you very much. I admit I started this. It's my... Actually, no, it was Representative Roblin before I even got here this morning. I was going to behave fully today, I swear.
Well, just an interesting sidelight. My grandfather would never, ever let us go near the pigs.
Oh, yeah.
And my father actually had brucellosis, bovine brucellosis. So,
Mr. Chair,
I have some familiarity.
Just one second. Gary Whitney, Tom Wolf, Terry Witt, come on up. Let's have a little
Chair,
more.
Chair, I object. Don't let him respond.
Please.
Just while they're coming up, Representative Wingard, who I respect very much, speaks the truth. And he often is the back end of that costume for me.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my God.
I can
Mark, I skipped over you. I'll get you here on the backside.
I can be very, very brief. Mr. Chair, Terry Witt with Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We support this bill. And I would like to also support Representative Krieger's comment with regard to other animals of damage, including bear in the timber industry, cougars in the livestock industry, and encourage and the Department of Fish and Wildlife to consider some of these what I would call ancillary damage problems when dealing with some of these introduced species like the wolf, for example, that is going to cause some damage to our livestock people on the east side. So I think not only do we have to deal with these invasive species, but with the species that we introduce back into the state. I think that's something that we all need to be aware of, whether it's damage to forest products or damage to livestock.
Mm-hmm. Good testimony. Thank you. Tom, you want to...
Chair Clem, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf with Trout Unlimited. I also would like to just be very brief. We support House Bill 2221. Feral swine has been mentioned, the impact they have. They are have shown to be have tremendous impact on riparian areas. They will get in and root out small shrubs. They will have damage on the streams. And effort by this bill and by ODFW to eradicate this non-native species we think would be justified. So we do support this bill and hope that you pass it. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Gary?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Gary Whitney, Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts, and very briefly, we're here to voice our support, the 45-member Oregon. When you say Oregon and soil together, it's oral. Oregon Soil and Water Conservation Districts fully support House Bill 2221. We agree that they cause a lot of problems to the environment. They hang out because they can't sweat. They like to hang out in cool, moist areas and root up the soil and eat all the riparian vegetation. And then, so then the bare soil turns to sediment and water pollution. That's all I have.
Right. Questions? Representative, who wants it first?
Nope, Gilliam. I called him a name earlier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You all don't have to necessarily comment on this, but I just want to go on record that I didn't realize how disruptive and invasive feral pigs could be. But I've had some concern for my district, kind of leading up to the possibility of this bill, that it would in any way encroach or stop momentum towards private hunting, whether it's pheasants or whatever. I mean, obviously, the mitigation here is how disruptive and damaging these pigs are. But I just wanted to go on record as saying that I've heard that concern. It's not necessarily a defense of feral pigs, but just the concern about the issue of private hunts.
Mm-hmm. Representative Verblin.
His issue is one, I think that this bill only lets those that are out wild and loose. If you had animals pinned in and you want to come shoot them, that would probably be a different issue. I guess the only thing I would say on this one is that while people are out, I just, it's a comment, when you're out finding these feral swine, if you see a nutria, you can take it too.
yeah,
another
that's
problem.
True.
But it's doing the same things to the watersheds and the areas where they exist. So just a comment.
Thank you. Vice Chair Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. That raises a question for me. Are there other hunting opportunities where private landowners can charge for people to come, or is this the exception?
Exception. Answer.
So the other hunting that Representative Gilliam was referring to means that the private landowners are basically letting you come, but they're not charging you to come.
No, charging.
We might want to get them.
Yeah, we'll if we hold that after we excuse this panel, I'll have to come back up.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Any more for these folks? Great, thanks. So, Kurt, you want to come back up, and then we'll get Steve and Kapori and Mark Zitzma on their way, too.
Chair Clem, Representative Van Orman, if I understood the question, this bill would not affect any of the other hunting programs that private landowners currently have. So, for instance, there's a large industry of fee-based pheasant hunts where a landowner will charge either for access or charge a fee to come and hunt on their land, either for wild birds or birds that are released. This bill does not affect any of those. It only affects the sale of hunts for feral pigs.
Okay. Thank you.
If I'm right, I mean, theoretically, even the transferability portion of a landowner preference tag for deer or elk is something where technically you're charging to have access to that tag, and then you give them permission to your land.
I believe under the landowner preference program, Chair Clem, members of the committee, under the landowner preference program, we don't allow the sale of tags. Individuals can register non-family members, and then what they end up doing is charging an access fee to hunt on their land as opposed to buying the tag. But that's a different, entirely different
right.
issue.
So may I follow up, please? Yeah. So essentially what you're talking, so the difference really is access fee to property as opposed to actually charging people to come hunt.
Chair Clem, Representative Van Orman, both of those occur on private
yes,
land right now.
But there is a difference between charging people to come hunt on your property as opposed to charging people simply to have access to your property to hunt whatever, other than the feral pig that we're talking about.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. I think I get it.
Yeah, if you wade much further into it, there's a whole set of bills that I don't know if they're going to be here this session that get into some of this and who does it and who doesn't and a variety of things. So we'll brief you on it sometime in your office.
Okay.
Let's see. Mark, I skipped over you first, so how about we get you going and then do you see
it? Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. As I mentioned before, my name is Mark Sitzma. I'm here representing the Oregon Invasive Species Council on this bill. As I mentioned previously, the council has a mission to coordinate a comprehensive effort to keep invasive species out of Oregon and to eliminate, reduce, or mitigate impacts of invasive species already present in the state. And since the legislature created the council in 2001, during that session, we had our first meeting in January 2002, and wild pigs or feral swine were an issue back then. So they've been an issue for the council since the very first meeting. We developed a risk assessment in 2004 that identified feral swine as a high-risk species in the state, and then in 2007 we developed a management plan for feral swine in the state that lays out a program for how to eradicate them in the state. So the council strongly supports this bill. It addresses one of the critical first steps that are necessary to eradicate these pigs from Oregon, because it removes this financial incentive for individuals to release and maintain wild pigs on their property. So the plan we have lays out a clear path to eradication of wild pigs. We know that it can be done if we act soon. In November, ODFNW responded to a report of a population of wild pigs north of Vail and at Bully Creek Reservoir, and they eradicated the entire population of 19 pigs in a couple weeks. So this is how we should address all invasive species management in the state. Or problems in the state. We need to act quickly on new populations that are geographically remote from core populations, and then work on those satellite populations or how things spread quickly, and then work at eradicating those core populations where these pigs are coming from. And a personal note, as many people on the committee, I grew up in the Midwest on a hog farm in Iowa. I've seen domestic hogs attack my dog, attack my father, attack me, destroy the forest when they escape. So I really have a personal interest in seeing pigs eradicated from Oregon. And thank you very much for...
You want one of our if you see it, shoot it bumper stickers we're going to have commissioned from this committee here later.
Representative Shoffler.
Yeah, a pig will eat you, kill you, eat you. Where did you grow up?
Oskaloosa, Iowa.
Oh, I grew up in Webster City, Iowa. Yep. I'm a Hawkeye.
Yeah.
Among all these beavers and ducks.
Which one's the predator in this situation?
I'd be a bad.
Any questions for Mark and Steve? Reverend's Wisness wondering, what in the world do we do in this committee here? Steve, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafori. I'm here representing the Wildlife Society, Oregon chapter.
Wildlife Society is the Society of Wildlife Biologists, a scientific society. As such, we generally don't get involved in the politics of legislation, but we want to bring the science. I will not be redundant. You've heard pretty much all the problems with feral pigs. I did want to add one fact that you may remember the spinach E. coli problem that happened a few years ago and some people died. Mm-hmm. That spinach E. coli originated from some wild pigs' excrement in the spinach field. So it can be dangerous to humans as well as to domestic livestock as well as to the environment. I did want to point one thing out to Representative Gilliam. One issue in this bill has not been mentioned, and that's Section 3. Arguably, in Section 3, if you went to a farmer and said, I'd like to go hunt the feral pigs on your land, and the guy said no, and is not doing anything about it himself to hunt those feral pigs, then he would be a violation of the bill. So there's an affirmative obligation in Section 3 in the bill that you have to do something. If you've got them on your property, you are obligated to do something about it. And I think, as I say, you might find yourself in trouble if you refuse to let somebody come on and get your pigs. Now, we take no stance on that one way or another. That's a political issue for you. I just want the committee to be aware of it.
Any questions for this panel? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kurt, what do you think about that possible conflict that Mr. Kafour just pointed out? Loophole, I guess.
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, I think Mr. Kafour is correct. Those pigs would have to be, though, meet the definition of feral. And so pigs that are contained and confined under the Department of Agriculture's regulations clearly would not be subject to this statute. Our goal in writing this language was to not only on public land or on private land, but also on the public land side, to have people take responsibility when they know there's pigs there. There's opportunities out there. We work closely with the USDA Wildlife Services folks, and they do feral pig control for us as well. We've had the Bully Creek Reservoir situation was mentioned. And actually, I don't want to take credit for that, because before we got there, the locals had already taken care of the problem and taken care of, eradicated the population. So I think it is an issue. It's we're looking for landowners to take some responsibility as well.
Follow up just to annoy those that want to ask questions.
Yeah.
Kurt. You just help me. I want to go on record and make sure that people understand what you're trying to do. And I believe that you are trying to get at this problem. This has nothing to do with the department's attitude or agenda about other private hunts for other species. That's correct.
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, that's absolutely correct.
And back to the other question, is it possible under this bill that you could see someone coming to your private property and saying, I know you have a feral pig problem, and I need to come on and help you with that. I'd like to come on and hunt, or I'm insisting that I come on and hunt. Is that a possibility in your interpretation?
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, that would not be my interpretation. Nothing here forces the trespass issue or supersedes those statutes. So that's certainly not our intent, and if there's concerns there, we're happy to discuss that.
Discuss it.
Yeah.
Okay. And one last one, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you coming, and I know you're in this building a lot. I just want to be sure, are you personally satisfied with your representation in the building?
Chair Clem,
where do you live?
Members of the committee, I've been very satisfied with my representation in the building, both on the House and the Senate side, so I'd like to go on record.
Can we just get your address, please?
Yeah, all right then. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Chair. Our largest landowner in Oregon, are they helping us with the eradication of this of feral swine? That being the federal government.
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, we certainly work very closely with the federal land managers on this issue. I can come back with more details in terms of the relationship. I'm not aware of any
unlike the wild horse situation, I'm not aware of any negativity from the federal land management managers with regard to our interest in eradicating these populations.
So we haven't had any access problems for hunters to go take these on federal lands?
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, not that I'm aware of.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Shoffler?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, some of the things that, if I'm interpreting what I've heard correctly, kind of raise some flags for me. So the language in this bill would not force a private landowner to allow hunters on their land if they thought or knew there were feral pigs on the land. And then also, would the private landowner be forced to allow state workers onto their land if they found there were feral swine present, and the landowner refused to allow private hunters onto their land?
Chair Clem, Representative Shoffler, that's certainly not our intent or our interpretation of this.
Mr. Chair, I think the plain language in Section 2, Subsection 2 of Section 3, requires a person who knows he has feral swine on his land to either do it himself or cause it to be done by someone else. So I think that if a hunter came to ODFW, for example, and said, Farmer Jones has got feral pigs on there, he knows he has feral pigs on there, I've asked him to do something about it, to come on and help him, he refuses, and he's not doing it himself, then Farmer Jones could be in violation of this bill as drafted right now.
Well, then may I, Mr. Chair? Then what would the farmer be? Would the farmer be fined or punished or penalized? I don't want to go down that road. Okay, that's not what I want to do.
Class A misdemeanor. So let's just walk it through for a moment. So a person or employee of that person who's a land manager shall take, hunt, or trap, or cause to be taken, hunt, or trapped any feral swine that roams on land owned or controlled by that person. So on a practical level, they're supposed to do some of those things. If they don't, it's Class A misdemeanor, and somebody, it wouldn't be obviously just any state employees, a game warden would knock and say, we believe that there are feral swine on the property, and there is a statute that says that needs to be taken care of. Are there? What you doing? And if they were totally trying to hide it, then I would think there would be some option to try and prove in court that they were guilty of a misdemeanor. I mean, I don't know if it's in court. Well, I guess it's in court at some level, right?
Yeah. And Chair Clem, Representative Shoffler, as I mentioned, we do work with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and their wildlife services staff if we have a feral swine population on private land and the landowner wants assistance, we have the ability to provide that.
Mr. Chair, let me clarify.
Yep.
I'm all for offering assistance, but you could say the same for blackberries or ivy or gorse or whatever that stuff is. There's any number of things that would,
ragwort,
if you use this same logic, would force someone to allow any number of people onto their land. And I'm all for offering. I guess maybe it's not even a problem. Maybe every landowner in Oregon wants to deal with this problem. But I'm worried about the possibility of someone just having to say, okay, I have to let you on my land. That really, I'm not interested in that.
And wouldn't it just really be law enforcement who enforces? If someone had to do an investigation to see whether you were guilty of a misdemeanor, wouldn't that be a police officer or law enforcement?
If I may.
Yep, whoever wants to answer that.
No, I'm not going to answer. Kurt, you going to answer
that?
The short answer, Representative, or Chair Clem, is yes, that's correct.
So, please.
Look, you could be a landowner out there, and through no fault of your own, these pigs are on, so why are you guilty of something? I'm really struggling.
It may not be your pig.
I'm struggling with this.
Yeah.
And I'm glad Mr. Crofori brought it up, because it's just probably more complicated than I assumed it was. And I'm just leery of forcing someone to let people on their land, saying someone's guilty of something that they're through no fault of their own, there's a pig on their land. Now they got to let everybody and their dog on there to own them.
I think we could work on an amendment that basically says they're notified. If after you've been notified, then you don't
take, hunt, trap, or cause to be taken, hunt, or trap, or call, or something, you know, an X period of time, you know, then, yeah, you know they're there, you had the chance to dispute it, you know, and you
or
just
do
don't want
it.
To. Yeah. Yeah, or hunt them yourself, and you just don't want to.
And then the state would take care of it.
Right, then the state would be able
That's
to.
That's better.
Yeah. So, Representative Roblin, we're not in work session, I know.
By your definition of the feral swine, if I have my property fenced, I could say any swine on there is my contained within my property is not a feral swine by your definition. Isn't that not correct?
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, that's correct as long as it meets the Department of Agriculture fencing. They have rules on fencing.
Right.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's interesting.
So we're in public here. We're not in work session, but I think I see what we probably need to do from here. God, I could make such a good joke about sausage making right now, but I'm just going to let it go. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, I've been holding one for 10 minutes.
And we're proud of you.
I may still take an opportunity.
I'm going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2221. Going to take a bill out of order because we've got some folks who've come a long way, including our good friend Representative Wisner, who's come from at least down the hall, I know. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2424.
A good number.
Representative,
Representative, do you just want to start with yourself, or do you want Brenda to come up now?
Yeah. And he went to this one instead of my bill. Now I'm on this.
Good morning, Chair Clem and honorable committee members. What a committee this is. I'm Representative Gene Wisnett, District 53, rural Deschutes County. I'd like to thank the chair for hearing this bill and also co-sponsoring with me House Bill 2424. This is about eradicating senators who want to eradicate the pit bulls. Is that right?
No, that's 2425. We're hearing that tomorrow.
Seriously, this is a good bill. House Bill 2424 just adds the removal of noxious weeds as part of the Oregon's Adopt a Highway program. Last summer, I was contacted by the nice lady on my left, Brenda Pace, who's a constituent with this idea. And since I'm an avid supporter of programs calling for removal of noxious weeds, for example, Sun River has a long-standing active program to eliminate noxious weeds. And our county has an annual Let's Pull Together event where volunteers spend the day pulling noxious weeds. My wife and I have participated in this event for several years. Cheryl Howard, the Let's Pull Together coordinator, Dan Sherwin, the Deschutes County Vegetation Manager, Brenda Pace, and Tiffany Lewis from my staff, we all met to discuss Brenda's idea and draft this bill last summer. Our team also planned our strategy for getting support of this, and you have a letter from Marion County, State Weed Advisory Board, and other. We had support from other county boards. And we captured many supporters in the House and Senate to sponsor our bill. Committee members and Mr. Chair, the 1999 study found that noxious weeds affect some farming, livestock, and other industries cost Oregon $83 million or 3,300 jobs a year. The Oregon Department of Agriculture estimates that 1.4% of Oregon landmass is occupied by noxious weeds. The state recognizes the threat of invasive species, including noxious weeds, but has not been able to fund an aggressive and effective program. The effort created by this bill will further educate our citizens about noxious weeds and demonstrate how volunteerism by our citizens can help fight these unwelcome weeds. Again, thanks to Mrs. Pace for her idea and leadership in this program and the bill, and thanks to Cheryl and Hope Howard for their great program, Let's Pull Together in Deschutes County, and Dan Sherwin for his support and leadership within our county. I urge all of you to support this bill, and let's pull some noxious weeds.
Thank you, Representative.
What we got?
I think the discussion is complete.
No. Brenda, would you any question for Representative Wisdom? Do you need to get back?
Yeah.
Representative Shoffler.
Oh, yeah, only Mr. and Mrs. Frazee are good neighbors up the road from me, and they, Mr. Frazee, they've adopted our street to clean it up, the litter, and he's dedicated it to the ship. He was on Veterans, and forgive me for not remembering. I drive by the sign every day. When this passes, I'm going to say, Mr. Frazee, now not only can you pick up litter when you come by my house, you drive right by my yard, you can pull some of them noxious weeds coming from my yard. So this is great for me, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Schaffler, thank you for those comments. Yeah, and the details of the bill, it's volunteer. We think it's a program worth doing. If you're going to pick up the trash, we hope you'll pick up the noxious weeds and vice versa. And as you all know, that because you're on this committee, that each county has different noxious weeds, so there will be a training program that we'll implement through the rules about how which weeds to pull and how to pull them. And it's interesting, I got a conversation, a call from a guy in Matters was telling me all the history of the knapweeds in Oregon about that the railroads put them here. Is anyone here from the railroad company that they used them to keep the hold down the fires along the rail lines back many years ago? So, again, thank the committee and the chair for, I think it's a good program. What came from, this demonstrates how good ideas come from the people, not necessarily us 90 people in this building. And we take that and work with them, and we appreciate it.
I would note for the record, there's in the middle of Representative Wisden's testimony, they talked about the plan strategy for support, which includes Marion County. You'll note that 8 days after I got assigned chair of this committee, Marion County commissioners have all signed a letter saying what a great idea this is. And I'm a co-sponsor of this bill, I think, about a day after that.
Strategy.
Yeah, it's good. Just for future reference for everybody, the key, too, is my wife, because she, when we drive during Scotch Broom time, that's all we discuss the entire time, and when Representative Wisden came to see me, I didn't think about all the other elements other than, oh boy, if we could actually get some help on those Scotch Broom, my drives and my wife will be much happier. And so that's a key linchpin for me. Representative Wingard, question, comment?
Hey, Representative Wisden, I just want to thank you and Brenda for bringing this forward. Brenda, you actually stole my idea, but you deserve the credit for it because I didn't move fast enough. But for a couple of years now, since I became kind of aware of the invasive species and noxious weed problem, and it's pretty obvious, as the chair says, when you drive on our highways, you see the Scotch Broom and so many others. I've thought, you know, wouldn't it be great if the SOLVE program, which goes on the beaches, could target, you know, all of our main thoroughfares and pull those weeds. So I'm really excited to see this added to the Adopt the Highway program, and it's a great bill, and I really appreciate you bringing it forward.
If I could add...
And I think we need you to identify yourself for the record.
I'm Brenda Pace. I'm from Bend, Oregon, 60738 Gulf Village Loop. I'd like to add that one of the things the ODOT Adopt a Highway has done is make people feel responsible for their own front yards. Mm-hmm. And I think SOLVE has great programs, and all these special weed pulls are great programs. But if we get people involved in their own front yards, I think it'll be having a long-term impact and a day-to-day impact, because weeds aren't like some other creatures. You know, you have to go out several times in a year. You can't just go out once and have the litter gone. If you go out once, the weeds will be back in 2 weeks again. I deal with spotted knapweed, and we have to go out four times during that period. So one of the provisions of this is we can have separate volunteer groups for the weeds, separate from the litter people. And that's really important, because pulling weeds is a different animal than picking up litter, even though ODOT has the structure that accommodates both, absolutely within the same structure, the volunteer services, the insurance, and all of that. It does add a group, a possibly different group than the litter people themselves.
Excuse myself, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please. Thanks. Thank you for coming, Representative Wisden.
Thank you.
Brenda, anything else you want to add? You think you're okay?
Thank you very much for bringing the idea forward.
Thank you.
I think it's an excellent one. Okay. I have Terry Witt, Mark Sitzma, Tom Wolf, and then Amy Joyce from ODOT after this next panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Terry Witt with Oregonians for Food and Shelter. Brenda came before the Marion County Weed Advisory Board last spring to bring forth this concept, and at that point in time, the board was enthusiastic about it, and I worked with Brenda to kind of get her into the system, and she did at that point then work with Representative Wisnett. couple things I'd like to mention is that, number one, roadsides are probably one of the major vehicles for spreading noxious weeds throughout the state. Seeds are picked up by vehicles and transported. Typically, since roadsides are not private property, they're one of the last things to get dealt with, particularly with county budgets being cut back on vegetation management. They then become established and very quickly spread into farm fields and become major problems because farmers are not technically supposed to go beyond their fence line to treat all the way out to the road. So it is a major, major vehicle for spread of noxious weeds throughout the state. One of the things that we did do in the bill, as you will note, and I know Representative Schaffler asked me a question this morning about the prohibition of using herbicides. We really do not want citizens who are untrained or unlicensed in applying pesticides to public lands to be out there with a backpack on their back spraying. We want to leave that to the county and public employees that treat those roadsides and are trained and licensed to do so. The other thing that this does allow is that it creates a situation for education, which I think is probably as important as getting people out there at physically pulling weeds. There are some weeds, for example, that you do not want to clip off at the base. You don't want to run over them with a mower, because by cutting off the weed at the base, you encourage that weed, particularly bushy species, to resprout three or four new plants for every one that you initially cut. So there is some education in terms of how you deal with invasive species. The other thing that we foresee this program doing is if there are those particularly noxious weeds or poisonous weeds that create a problem for humans to come in contact with or are not able to be pulled, that they could easily be flagged, and then county roadside crews could come out and spot treat those particular species to help eliminate them. The other thing that they can do is clip seed heads during the time where these plants are going into production of seed. They don't necessarily have to pull the plant if they can clip the seed head and stop the seed bank from being generated. That's another way to help curb the spread of noxious weeds. So we totally support this concept from OFS and from the Marion County Weed Advisory Board, and would encourage your aye vote.
Mark.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. Mark Sitzma here representing the Oregon Invasive Species Council. The council supports this bill strongly. Brenda also came to the council with this idea. We thought it was a good idea and that it's really a good way, as Terry mentioned, to both educate the public and engage the public in invasive species management. I think there are some details that ODOT and ODA have to work out about some of these issues that Terry brought up about when to manage the plants and how and what the correct protocols are, but I don't think that's a very onerous job, and I think it could be easily done. So we support the bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you.
Chair Clem, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf, Trout Unlimited. We support this bill. We think it's a good bill. That's kind of the last area that's not really being dealt with in invasives is public roadways. There's already a lot of private landowners that are doing a lot to eradicate invasive species on their land, and the public managers are doing a lot. So now this is a great bill that will open up the uncharted territory and allow volunteers to go out and eradicate these noxious weeds. And I agree with Mark and Terry that we need to have an education program so that volunteers can know what the most effective method is to eradicate these weeds. But otherwise, I think this is a great bill and should be passed. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Just one sec, Brenda. Questions for this panel?
Just a comment.
Representative Roman.
Just a comment. Thank you, Chair. And that is that when I was taking botany at in college, University of Washington, everything I planted died. And to see these plants just go up, you know, come off a tire and grow drives me crazy. So if anybody who wants to pull them out, I'm really there to support them.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you come down to Representative Roblin's district and mine and get south, I would say that three-fourths of Highway 101 is covered with gorse.
It's amazing.
Yep. And Scotch bloom, and the state of Oregon has made very little effort. And because of the size of it, it'd have to be sprayed. But, you know, there's so much work to be done, and I think that department needs to get maybe a letter from the committee or something. Hey, get with it. The law says they're to do it.
And I remember when I first got here last session, there was some opportunity to finally ask about the Scotch broom somewhere. And they said, yeah, we basically have given up on pulling and things, and so we need some biological agent, like a beetle. It seemed like somebody was working on a situation. But I wondered what it would take, how many prisoners, how many whatever, how many volunteers it would take to actually try and yank it all out by hand. And the answer was that's not happening to me at that time. I don't know.
They wanted an animal the size of a rhinoceros.
And they need, I mean, there's another one, I guess it's Portuguese broom that's kind of down in the that area, too, and it's bigger and worse than the other two. And then we also have butterfly plant that was going all over our area, which is another one. Tears up roads, tears up sidewalks. They're pretty remarkable what these plants can do. And these are ones you aren't going to pull out. I mean, that's the problem. It's not going to be the solution.
Representative Clem and Representative Krieger, one of the things that I know, for example, with the Marion County Weed Advisory Board, one of the things that we are making available to residents is some of the tools. They do have what are known as weed wrenches, which allow you to actually pull out a fairly good-sized Scotch broom plant.
Wow.
Now, obviously, you're not going to go down to some of these totally infested areas and clear them out, but those are good tools to use where you have a new established Scotch broom planting where you can actually go in and actually wrench them out with not a whole lot of backbreaking effort.
One last comment, and I'll go back down to Representative Krieger's area. You know, the biscuit fire, I have told people in all the studies that I did, our invasive species are going to take over that. We aren't going to get a forest back for a long time. And I need to, especially Scotch broom, because you don't get a forest growing through Scotch broom when it covers up the deal. It's there for a long time before you ever get the next generation. So it won't be the same as it, you know, this natural progression forest that we have been used to on the West Coast if we don't take action.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Yeah. Thanks, gentlemen. Amy, Joyce, and then Brenda, did you want to make another comment? You're welcome to come up again. Especially when you've come from more than 100 miles, you get special treatment with the committee. And you're a volunteer citizen, too.
I just wanted to comment on the training that was mentioned, because that had been anticipated when we wrote the legislation as something that would come after in an OAR, because there is an OAR dealing with the Adopt a Highway. And since the details generally are contained in the OAR, we thought that training aspect should be included there. And what we thought was the way to make it easiest so that ODOT and ODA don't have to be largely involved in this training session is for the ODOT to maintain, as I think most regions have, lists of people that they rely on as weed specialists, people that they know, so that any group that wanted to apply to do weeds would call ODOT, get that list of reliable names, go to one of those people and create a weed plan saying what they're going to get, what they're going to take out, how they're going to take it out, when they're going to take it out, how often they're going to take it out, what equipment they need to do that, and what they need to protect in the same vicinity. And with that written and signed off by that weed specialist, the group that wants to pull weeds could take that in with their application. So ODOT would already have a weed plan developed by the weed group that is signed off by a weed specialist. So I'm not sure what, in addition, ODOT
thinks they need to do in that connection, because it's in the OAR, it would say that members of the weed group would have to comply with the weed plan. So that was our idea, to sort of finish off this training issue, because I think that's very real. People can go out and pull the wrong things and have it grow twice as fast. And about your scotch broom, I think people can do something about chunking out the big parts so that the rest could be sprayed. That makes the spraying much more even, but the state do the spraying, and the weed volunteer people help cut off the mass of the plant, things like that. So those were the two things that I wanted to mention. Is training, I think, is really important, and I know Doc thinks so too.
Thanks. We need to hear from Amy before we run out of time. Thanks. Hi.
Good afternoon, Amy, or morning. Amy Joyce, Department of Transportation. Adopt a Highway has been a really successful program for people to volunteer to beautify our highways, and the mandatory part under Adopt a Highway right now is litter pickup. Folks can do other things in addition to it, but that is the primary function. And the program is really remarkable for both its simplicity and its success. Quite simply, a volunteer group comes in, one-page application, volunteers sign a quick release. They have to participate in a brief training, and away they go picking up garbage. The training right now is about a 15-minute video. They pick up garbage and bag it. If they see something hazardous, they flag it. ODOT comes along later in the day, picks up bags of garbage, picks up those hazardous things, and it's a success for everybody, and it's a cost savings for Oregon taxpayers. And so we have about 700 groups currently active in Adopt a Highway for picking up litter, and some of them take care of huge swaths of highway. Several groups in our District 14, which is Malheur and surrounding counties, take care of like 22 miles of highway at a time. So it's a fantastic program for everybody, and it really makes a significant difference for our litter pickup. From ODOT's perspective, we came up with three items for the committee just to consider here. One is that the bill does not change the law in regards to allowing only one group per section of the highway. My understanding is that the intent may be to allow both litter pickup by one group and weed pulling by a different group on the same stretch. If that's the intent, a quick amendment would take care of that, but I think as drafted, the bill doesn't yet do that, but that's a simple amendment. To encourage the original beautification goal of Adopt a Highway, we would ask the committee to consider requiring those who adopt for weeds to also pick up litter at least until perhaps another group came along and volunteered to do the litter. We could envision a weed group and a service organization partnering, adopting the same stretch at the same time, so both activities could be taken care of. But considering that the original and primary intent of Adopt a Highway has been litter pickup, ask you to consider making that litter pickup a mandatory piece. And then we've talked somewhat, folks have talked already about training. That's another aspect of it. Training to pick noxious weeds is more complex than simple litter pickup instruction. We anticipate that we would partner with our colleagues at Department of Agriculture, who are frankly more expert in this area than we are. Ms. Pace's idea about a weed plan sounds good. But we would need to train folks more in depth and on a different topic than mere highway safety, and our friends at Department of Agriculture could help with that. So with a few minor changes, I think the bill gets probably the sponsor where they want to go.
Any questions? Just one. ODOT's funded, generally speaking, out of the highway trust fund.
Correct.
And you are allowed to pay for the spraying weeds removal that your employees do?
Chair Clem, that's right. That's considered part of an allowable piece of the highway fund.
So
right?
You may be sorry you brought the third one up, but I have to ask. If Department of Ag were to be involved, you would be able to pay them for their assistance?
Chair Clem, I could check on that. It seems that if it's a piece of that, it's on some level it's one pot of state money or another, and it's not a huge amount of.
I think about this.
And it's not a large amount of money. I think both Ag and ODOT put a very minimal fiscal on this. It's not going to cost a lot of money to do either way.
thank you. Otherwise, good suggestions. I'm not sure in the middle one, when a volunteer's coming, I'm not sure I'm going to require them to do something else since they might just not volunteer, but I hear you. Well, I'm sure we'll all think about that. Anything else?
I want to talk more about... I want to talk more about the lack of salvaging and replanting and managing these burned areas where a bunch of people who don't know how to manage the forest have been allowed to take control of those areas. But that's for another day, Mr. Chair.
We will talk about that another day.
Apparently not.
Sure
I didn't bring it up either.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2424. I'm going to enter into the record some testimony that you all have from Thursday night's hearing. This is some written testimony that came in. And I'm going to carry over. Thank you. House Bill 2714. Another representative for Roblin Bill. We'll get to have him in front of us again.
Exciting.
On Thursday. Thank you. And committee is adjourned.
I didn't know.